Deep underwater lurks a mysterious man-made illness. It's gone by many names over the years. Satan's disease, diver's palsy, the chokes. But today's medicals call it decompression sickness. You know it as the bends. British diver Martin Robson faces this each time he plunges beneath the surface. In the winter of 2012, Robson was diving in southern Russia. What happened next has become the subject of a new book called Between the Devil and the Deep, One Man's Battle to Beat the Bends, by Martin Robson. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Martin himself. Martin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Thanks for having me on.
The pleasure is all mine. Now, before we get going on this, just explain to me a little bit about what sort of diving we're talking about. Because you're talking about a man here whose experience of diving is basically snorkeling off Corfu when he was about 12, and also, you know, watching The Big Blue and Enzo. So let me talk to me about what sort of diving that you do.
Basically, it's not always, but mostly it's quite deep, and we use some fairly high-tech equipment to get us there. So without getting too technical, most sort of holiday scuba divers would have a single cylinder of air, compressed air on their back, and they'd go swimming underwater. If they were fairly new, their depth limit would probably be about 18 meters. When I was in the Blue Lake and on other dives, we regularly dive deeper than 200 meters, blimey, which is a long way down, but an even longer way back up. And we also use some fairly high tech equipment called rebreathers, which basically capture every exhaled breath from the diver, so there's no bubbles. Basically what looks like a bucket full of kitty litter, but it's a special chemical that is behind you, and it scrubs out all the carbon dioxide. And then we use gas analyzers to analyze the remaining gas, which talk to a computer, very much like The Abyss, the movie, but talk to a computer, which we can control via some buttons to provide us with the perfect gas mix for whatever depth we're diving to.
Fascinating. And presumably when you go on these dives, is it scientific? I know people who used to dive on the North Sea oil rigs and go down the bit shaft, you know, and do that sort of diving, which is absolutely a job for madmen, I probably think. But what sort of backup team do you have on the surface for you when you're doing these dives?
Well, it depends. Sometimes it's very limited. It's just myself and a few friends. If we're going on an expedition to, say, explore a submerged cave system, then it really is done on a shoestring. But the project in Russia attracted a lot of media attention. It's actually quite a well-known sort of holiday spot as well. And the project was not mine. It was originally started by some geologists who basically had very limited information about, you know, the source of the water, the structure of the rocks. So a lot of the dives were scientific. I wasn't doing the science, but I was collecting water samples, collecting rock samples, taking photographs, and basically trying to explore to see if I could find the source of the water.
Right. Were you a Navy diver? What was your introduction into diving? How did you get into this? Because it's not something, you don't suddenly think, right, I'm going to be a diver. You know, I've seen Abyss. I've got all the kit, I've got all the gear and no idea. Off I go.
Well, for my sins, I was in a previous life, I was in the Royal Marine Commandos and did a little bit of diving there.
Right.
And when I left, it was just something I had a passion for and just continued, really. I just never stopped.
So tell me then about this, the lake itself then, Blue Lake, and, you know, what happens then on actually, before we get to there, tell me a little bit about what we know as the bends then. I mean, it sounds like the nightmare that every diver has to think about before they go down.
Well, when you go diving with compressed air or any compressed gas, your body actually only, if you like, burns as a fuel the oxygen, and the rest in normal scuba diving would be exhaled. But the deeper you go, the more some of those gases that are not being burned. So typically, if you were just using a cylinder of air, that would be nitrogen. For us diving very, very deep, it's nitrogen and helium. But those gases get dissolved into your tissues until they reach the same pressure as the outside world, which is obviously quite a lot if you're underwater. Well, when you come back up, those bubbles have to come back out of your tissues, circulate around your body and get if you like, exhaled as evaporated gas.
Right.
If you come up too quickly, then those bubbles come out of your tissues in a very uncontrolled way and can get lodged in your joints or perhaps in other more vulnerable tissues, like in your spinal cord or in your brain even. And as those bubbles get trapped in your body and expand, they can cause anything from a little bit of a skin rash to quite uncomfortable joint pain through to paralysis, loss of control of your limbs, loss of control of some of your bodily functions, shutting down of your internal organs, and possibly in the worst case scenario, even death. And it can also happen if you've done everything right. If you dive very, very deep, we have to stop regularly on our way back to the surface to allow ourselves to re-engage some kind of equilibrium, to get rid of enough bubbles so that it's then safe to make another short ascent and stop again, get rid of some more bubbles. And even if you do everything perfectly, sometimes you can get what's called a sort of an undeserved bend. You did it all right, but today is just your unlucky day.
Yeah, I mean that. I mean, this is one of the things that when you are going on the edge of any sort of expedition, be it underwater, polar, I don't know, space, there's always a curveball. You can get everything, you can get all your ducks in a row, and then something comes out of nowhere and messes you up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, what happened on that day then? So you know, you've taken all precautions, and did you intend to go deeper than anybody had gone before then, or did it just sort of happen that way?
I think it was 50-50. Even since being a small child, I've always sort of had a wonder about two things: that sort of like the Mother Nature and planet Earth, and myself. So there was a little bit of self experimentation. So basically, I was descending, and I got to what was considered to be sort of the bottom, and I was following a line down that had a weight on it, and this weight was just bouncing in free water, bobbing up and down. And it obviously wasn't on the bottom. And I could see the bottom sort of not only deeper, but ahead of me. And I just thought, well, I ought to go off exploring and have a look. So I did that.
Were you on your own then? Or did you have a buddy with you? Or had it all, you know, did people know what was going on? Presumably you wouldn't dive on your own, or would you?
No, I was on my own, and the reason for that is because there is a risk. And yes, I had people to sort of to help me. So basically, on the way back up, I had teams of divers who were going to meet me at various depths. But if they dive very, very deep themselves, then they are at risk.
Yeah.
And it means that the greater the number of people who have the potential to be in harm's way means that the backup and the surface support increases or has to increase exponentially. So in the very, very deep dives, I'm on my own, and then I meet some of my support divers as I get shallower. So the first group of support divers were about halfway up at about 100 meters.
So as always in these things, you dive deeper, you follow that bobbing thing to get how deep did you go? Did you register how deep you actually got to?
I had one of my computers said 209 meters.
Wow.
Another one said 209 and a little bit, and the third one said 214, I think.
Presumably, it was there any light down there, or is it absolute pitch dark when you get to that sort of level?
Pitch dark. It's absolute. It's black as your hat. It really is.
Wow. Okay. So you're on the way back up. You've dived that bit. Presumably, you'd met people. If you met your support groups on the way back up, I mean, had you checked in with them going back up?
Yes, I'd met some divers sort of like at 100 meters. I'd met some divers at 60 meters. I'd met some divers at 30 meters. And then by this time, I've been in the water for hours and hours. And then by the time I got to about 75 feet, basically, it felt like I'd been shot in the spine, an excruciating pain in my back. I couldn't move my legs at all. I couldn't maintain my buoyancy in the water, so I couldn't sort of like float neutrally buoyant, and I knew that I was probably in a spot of bother.
So what goes through your mind? I mean, obviously, you said you've been doing this for a while. You, as a previous life as a Royal Marine Commando, you obviously knew what was going on then. You were like, oh, fiddlesticks. Obviously not the words you used. You know, I've got, you know, I've got decompression sickness.
Well, the one thing that I do know is, and I'm not the only one, in these sorts of scenarios, the surface is not your friend.
Because obviously the thing you want to do, that if I was in this situation, which I'd probably never be, but I'd go, right, well, it's only 75 feet to the top, I'll go for it. That would probably be fatal.
Yeah, what would have happened is the bubbles would have come out of my tissues in so quickly, they just would have flooded into my bloodstream. They would have turned my blood into sort of froth, like the top of a sort of badly poured pint of beer, and the heart can't pump that, and I just would have died.
So, you did then what most medical people or scientists would say was you know the maddest thing you could possibly do. You presumably decided to sink.
Yes, I went back down. So the idea being that I go back down deep enough until the bubbles are recompressed. And hopefully some of the pain goes away because the bubbles are recompressed and I've done it very quickly. And then I just have to do the maths, solve the problem, and figure out the best way of taking as long as I possibly can to get back to the surface to try and prevent a sort of a mass exodus of bubbles from my tissues so that I'm in the best possible shape when I get to the surface to hopefully then be treated.
I mean, that's quite an impressive sort of thought process if you're under severe pain and you feel like you've been shot in the back. What were the rest of your team doing at this point as well?
A combination of looking at me like I was mad, looking at me saying, we don't understand what was going on, but one or two of them sort of guessed straight away and followed me down.
Presumably to give you more air and stay with you and make sure you could. Was there a danger of you losing consciousness or something like that as well whilst you were undergoing this situation?
Possibly, because you don't know what's going to happen. But the idea of going back down and compressing the bubbles is actually literally to give your body more time and hopefully to, like I say, recover enough to then get to the surface. If I had stayed where I was and continued with the decompression profile, you know, the number of stops and how long I stay in the water that we had planned for the original dive, then the one thing I knew was it was never going to get any better. It could well be a lot worse. I don't know if I'm going to even survive the journey to the surface. So really, I had no choice.
And presumably then, I mean, how long could you stay down? I mean, how long were the rebreathers going to work for? And did the rest of your team then sort of like ferry you or drop, I don't know how you do it, drop you, ferry you, get you the equipment down? Or was it a case of, you know, calling on sort of other methods of help and rescue?
Well, they're all the teams that meet me are all carrying extra cylinders for me, and then they can swap out some of the cylinders that I no longer need and give me fresh cylinders. But on the rebreather, the best option is to if it's going to be a very, very long dive, is we had something called a habitat there, which basically, if you imagine sort of getting an upturned glass and pushing it into just a bucket of water, then As you push it down, the pressure of water will just squeeze and eventually there'll be an airspace in there. And you can do that with anything. You can construct a habitat. So we had something that looked very similar to one of those bulk liquid containers with a seat in it. It was anchored to the rock and it was full of air. And that meant that the air inside is at the same pressure as the water outside. So I could get into that and I can be dry, I can eat, I can drink, and if necessary, I can swap out my rebreather for a fresh one brought down from the surface.
Right, absolutely. So were you, I mean, what goes through your mind when you're in this situation? I mean, obviously you're breaking it into sort of presumably into handleable chunks, so you know you'll be able to get into the habitat, you were able to think about, you know, how you were going to get out of the situation.
Yeah, so when I went down, when I descended, there was a point where I suddenly sort of got a little bit of sensation back in my legs. I managed to sort of trim myself out. We all try to say, like, literally kind of nice and flat in the water. And the first thing that went through my mind was that I am an idiot. And the reason that my legs felt heavy is because I must have flooded my dry suit. And one of my friends gave me a cylinder that I could plug into my dry suit to put more gas into, and that helped alleviate some of the dry suit squeeze. And I just felt, oops, maybe it's not a bend, maybe I've just flooded my dry suit. But right. I think in the back of my mind, I probably thought, well, that might be being a bit hopeful. So then you just think, okay, I now have, you know, however many hours, and I really can't remember, I now have to calculate that I've got this many more hours to do in the water just to try and give myself the chance of being in a good enough shape to survive getting to hospital. And then it's down to me, it's down to when I normally have a long decompression, which is a stop to wait before I can surface. I don't normally have any lights with me. I try not to look at any timers because, you know, if you've got to wait for another 3 or 4 hours in the water, then clock watching doesn't help. So you just try and I literally just try and shut down. Shut down my mind, don't think about anything, go completely blank. Probably how my friends think of me most of the time.
We've all got a friend like that, yes.
And just get through it sort of, if you like, step by step, but without trying to wait till that next step has ended and start the next step.
I mean, we won't go through it. We won't go through talking about step by step. We won't go through it step by step because obviously we want people to purchase the book, which you'll be able to do from the TRE virtual bookstore. But I mean, what was the feeling? I mean, were you conscious? I mean, when you got brought to the surface and rushed to hospital, were you aware of what was going on and had the danger sort of finished then, or was there even more to go through?
No, there was a lot more to go through. It actually wasn't a rush to the hospital. I climbed out the water with no more assistance than I would normally have after having been in the water for 10 hours. You know, it takes quite a toll on your body and you're quite tired. And there's obviously a transition from being weightless in the water to all that weight on your back on the surface.
Yeah.
But I had an expectation of what might be about to happen. So I had a hot drink. I had some warm soup. I got out of my diving clothes. I put sort of like, you know, ordinary street clothes on. And it was then that I went to the hospital. Not a long wait, but just basically to prepare myself for what I thought was about to happen.
What was it? Have you returned to the water since this happened? I mean, do you still do it today?
Absolutely.
I mean, you talk about in the book about this being that every diver is aware of it and every diver fears it. But when you've done this, didn't it? I mean, you say you've got, you know, you normally blank, but there must be something in the imagine, you know, in back in the back of your mind the next time you went to the water thinking, you know, this could happen again.
I suppose some of it is obviously a physical injury and like any other physical injury, I don't know, a torn muscle perhaps or a broken bone, despite what sort of athletes might tell you, I don't think they ever heal, you know, stronger than they were before. So there is a potential, but I really don't think that, although there's obviously some scar tissue from the injuries, if you're careful and you, like I say, you do it by the book, you know, go by the numbers, I don't think there's any more increased risk really. If you're just careful. And so the first thing I did when I was sort of like back diving again, which was only 3 months later, I think, was to take some people on a deep diving course. So where we were diving down to sort of 90, 100 meters. And the only thing that was a consideration was the guys who were with me, my students, actually said, look, if you think that you want to have an extra day off, this is to me, if you think you want to have an extra day off, or you want to dive a bit shallower, as long as we meet the standards of the course, we're all good with that. If you want us to help carry your equipment at the end of the dive, because physical exertion after diving is one of the things that can predispose you more to a bend on the surface.
Right.
So everyone was very, very helpful.
What was it? Were you approached? Did you think I want to write this book, or were you approached to write this book? And what did you hope? What do you hope that people take from it?
I did think about writing a book, but by nothing more than, I suppose, sort of accident chance, I got involved in giving a number of talks to live audiences about the accident and the subsequent treatment. And excuse me, on a few of those, there were people in the audience that I knew and basically said, you know, you should write a book. And then on one occasion, someone in the audience said, basically, yes, you should write a book. It's a really good story. And if you don't know how or you want some help, get in touch. And that's my co-author, Mark, who's brilliant throughout the whole process, who rather than just writing the story, he spent literally days and days and days with me. I even took him dry caving, which he said was going to terrify him. He followed me all the way over to France while I was teaching people cave diving, just so he could try and get to know me better and try and get inside my head to write a much better version of the story than I probably could have done.
So rather than being this happened, that happened, and this happened, and that happened, is actually a look at the whole holistic picture, as though some people would say.
Yeah, and he's done it brilliantly.
The book is called Between the Devil and the Deep. It's by Martin Robson. Martin, if people, you know, what would you recommend? Because presumably you still love diving, you still love that feeling in the water. You know, what's your high point? When, you know, what's been your high point since, you know, this incident? When have you looked around and gone, yeah, you know, I belong here?
Almost every time my fins touch the water. It's not just for me, it's more of a vocation. It's almost, you know, where I should be. I would admit that being on the surface on dry land is not necessarily my best environment. I just, you know, it's the beauty, the joy, the isolation, but not in an isolating way. It's just a magnificent place, and it just seems to be where I should be. Can I just mention one thing, though? The book, there are two of us who've written the book,
yeah.
and my co-author Mark Cowan shouldn't be excluded. You know, he's very much a part of it, and some of what he's done in explaining and using historical incidents of how, not just how people discovered decompression sickness, the bend, but also how it was treated, is really, really an interesting read as part of the whole story.
It is indeed. The book is called Between the Devil and the Deep, One Man's Battle to Beat the Bends. We're going to run out of time, but it's been fascinating to speak to you, Martin. If people want to find out more about you or by the book, do you have a website? Do you have social media?
Yeah. Martin Robson Diving is the website. Martin Robson Diving is also a link to my sort of like work Facebook page, and I'm sure they can track me down on my personal Facebook page, Martin Robson, from that.
Gonna run out of time, Martin Robson, so thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.